Love this podcast? Support this show through the Acast Supporter feature. It's up to you how much you give and there's no regular commitment. Just hit the link in the show description to support now.
Look out, he's only films to be buried with.
Hello and welcome to Films to be Buried With. My name is Brett Goldstein. I'm a comedian, an actor, a writer, a director, a boost bar, and I love film. As Ralph Waldo Emerson once said, for every minute you are angry, you lose 60 seconds of happiness, which is actually what the subtext to the Nick Cage, Angelina Jolie film Gone in 60 Seconds was about. The cars they were stealing were actually people's joy. It was surprisingly deep, that film, when you think about it. That's a good point, Ralph Waldo Emerson. It doesn't get the credit it deserves. Every week I invite a special guest over. I tell them they've died, then I get them to discuss their life through the films that meant the most to them. Previous guests include Barry Jenkins, Kevin Smith, Jameela Jamil, and even Bed Crambles. But this week, it's the amazing actor and musician, Ben Barnes. Head over to the Patreon at patreon.com/Brett Goldstein, where you get an extra 20 minutes of chat with Ben. We talk about beginnings and endings. He tells me an amazing secret. You get the whole episode uncut, ad-free, and as a video. Check it out over at patreon.com/Brett Goldstein. Ted Lasso Season 2 is now available in full on Apple TV+. You can watch the whole thing in one go. Plus, you can see Soulmate Season 1 on Amazon Prime. Watch them both. Why not? Bit of fun, innit? So Ben Barnes. Oh, Ben Barnes. Are you kidding? No, I'm not. He's really here. Ben Barnes is a brilliant actor. You know him as Prince Caspian. You know him from Westworld, from The Punisher. You know him from Shadow and Bone. He's also a singer. He's got his own album out, Songs for You. You should listen to it. It's fucking great. We recorded this on Zoom about a week ago, and I'd never met him before. Oh, we had so much fun together. He was so brilliant. I really think you're going to love this one. So that is it for now. I very much hope you enjoy episode 169 of Films to be Buried With. Hello and welcome to Films to be Buried With. It is I, Brett Goldstein, and I'm joined today by an actor. He's a Westworlder. He's a Shadow and Boner. He's the Prince of all of Narnia, I think. He is a man from Sutton, and he now lives in LA. He's a hero to many, a legend to most, and also he's fit. Please welcome to the show the brilliant Mr. Ben Barnes.
You said boner within 30 seconds of this.
That's the quickest I've got to it.
Yeah, the quickest you've done it so far. I did have a thought that, you know, groups of fans of shows often have names, and I toyed with the idea of calling them my Shadow and Boners, but then I've resisted the urge to even say that until this moment. That's the first time I've said it because you did it.
It starts here, the Shadow and Boners unite.
That was a very nice thing.
You've got to be the Shadow and Boners. I would be loud and proud of that.
You're going to get the credit for that now.
I'll take it.
On the Twitter.
I'll take it.
Yeah, you deserve it.
No regrets.
You deserve it.
Thank you, man. It's lovely to have you. This is the first time we've ever met.
Yeah.
So far, it's going great.
It's going very well.
I appreciate you doing this. Now, I've been aware of you for some time, Ben Barnes. You worked with friend of the podcast, Will Poulter, in Prince Caspian.
Yeah, and one of my best pals. He just took me out actually for a really lovely 20th birthday dinner. Mine, not his. He's about 15 still, but he's a lovely man.
What's a lovely man? But then, you know what I was, look, I've seen you in a lot of stuff. You're a very good actor, but you do something that I really, really like, and you did it in Westworld, which is, I think it's very brave. You play like a bad type, a bit of a bad type in Westworld. And I think you do it. You're very sort of charming in it, but you also don't at all shy away from the like really unpleasant sort of sleazy, sort of unattractive parts of that character. And I always think that that's really, I don't think a lot of actors do it. I think it's really cool and really brave because you're not protecting yourself you're not sort of, like there are people who play bad guys, but they play them like, yeah, but you love them because they're so charismatic and fun and cool. Like you allow in the parts that are like,
No, he's genuinely unpleasant as well, you know what I mean? And I think that's pretty brave. I like it.
Thank you. That's really nice. I've sort of found myself this odd little niche in the last sort of 5 or 6 years of playing these people who are slightly reprehensible, or either that they're sort of psychotic or evil or villainous or just guilty of just general douchebaggery. But I'm fully aware of how incapable I am of making a character particularly kind of like cool or anything like that. But whilst I'm not afraid of the grim, gross parts of it, I am quite protective of the humanity of them. I'm quite a sort of quite a soft, hopeful, desperate to be happy kind of person, and so I think that that gets a little bit infused into all of those characters. And like you described on Westworld, like when they asked me to come back for the second season, and it felt like such a privilege to be asked to sort of scratch away at the character a bit and look at his. Yeah. I know it sounds a bit. I was raised by psychiatrists and psychotherapists, but a little bit scratch away at his relationship with his dad. You see his relationship with his dad, and you peel away the onion a bit, and you see why he's so fucked up and why he's behaving like such a knob all the time to everyone. And because there are always reasons, always. And those things really interest me.
I love that. That's exactly what we're always trying to do on Ted Lasso. It's that thing of, and it's when you're a bad guy almost never thinks they're the bad guy, and they think that they're doing so, and you play all of that. I just think it's great. But I also, I'm trying to think of examples, but I don't want to name and shame, but I can think of people who play bad guys and you're almost like, you're not a bad guy. You're just fucking great. Like you're just entertaining and like it's, you're not allowing that character to be ugly, I suppose. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
Whereas I think you do that as well as all the charm and the everything. Anyway, that's my open fan mail to your face. That is from my section, fan mail to your face.
You do not do that. You are playing something which is entirely lovable from start to finish, even though that's not what's supposed to be on the page, and you can't help it. You can't help it at all. And now suddenly everyone in the world wants to like hug you like a teddy bear, and this makes you uncomfortable.
So moving on. Ben... So we've revealed how limited my abilities are. So... Ben Barnes, you live in LA. You've lived here 10 years, I believe.
Coming up on that, yeah.
And do you feel at home here? Is it still wild? How much of this? Because how old were you when you did Prince Caspian?
I was about 25,
and that was like the biggest thing that happened.
I thought you were going to say, and that was like quite a long time ago. So your face.
No. I mean, that's young.
You were doing maths.
Yeah.
quite right. I'll never tell.
Yeah, I'm very comfortable here. I do miss my friends and family, and you know, just London. I miss that a lot, but also very lucky to have the kind of lifestyle and job which takes me on adventures and takes me, you know, keeps me interesting. I think at least half of the time I'm not sort of at home. So I think that's a particular kind of lifestyle which I never imagined for myself and would certainly not curate if I did anything else for a living on purpose. But I do love that it is part of my life.
Can I ask you this? And we can, if you don't want to, we can cut it. Before we started recording this podcast, you told me something that was very interesting to me. I said, is there anything you're worried about talking about? And you said something like, I used to worry so much about that stuff, and now I'm very happy to talk about myself. And I wondered what had happened to lead you to that, if I may.
So I think it was a combination of things, but it was, I think very, very early on, I had some quite aggressive interactions with press, you know, doing sort of basically nothing, you know, a few plays and bits and pieces, and then doing the Narnia films, and suddenly people are interested in you and your life. And I remember having this conversation when I was about 25, and a journalist sort of said to me, you have to answer these kinds of questions if you want to do this for a living. And I, at 25, full of vim, said, no, I don't. I can keep anything I want to for myself. And I still fervently believe that. in that sort of freedom of choice, but it sort of, it tightened me and closed me off a bit to feel a bit defensive, I think, when talking about stuff. And I've done so many years of, you know, just sort of just by virtue of the way film and TV interviews work, I think, as well, like you're being asked about characters and things that you didn't necessarily write. But I think what happened was, I think the pandemic sort of kicked in and we all spent a year and a bit sitting around wondering what kind of people we want to be and where we fit in if we're not allowed to do the things we do on a regular basis and don't have the things that we have to look forward to regularly to keep us on the wheel and facing forwards. And who do we care about and what do we care about? And I wrote a lot of music in that time, and it was something I'd wanted to do for about 20 years. I'd started to do it about 20 something years ago and it had fallen apart. And I've done it as part of my career all the way through. I've always kind of done that, but always in someone else's voice. I think I've always, even when I was a kid at school, I did Sinatra tribute concerts and Stevie Wonder soul nights and things like that. And I would love it so much. And then in my films, I've played street buskers, Americana folk street buskers. And I played a crap rock star in a comedy, singing sort of like new romantic stadium rock crap. But it was never me. And I think that it just the clock ticked down on having to make something of my own that was sort of me that I haven't played. It's sort of obvious to sort of think, well, if you spend 20 years pretending to be other people, at some point you're going to want to do something that's yours. But I hadn't really thought about it until the pandemic. And then I wrote a sort of collection of songs which I've just released. And it sort of freed up the style of interview, the way I've been talking about it, people asking me about me, not about, you know, sort of sordid details of your life or anything, but just interested in me and what it takes to make something from myself. And that really, like, just sort of freed me up to feel the most me I could feel, which I think a lot of us felt a bit, particularly during the pandemic, felt a bit floaty and disconnected and all of that. I think most of the people that I know felt a little bit disassociated for a lot of it. And so I think I'm just sort of trying to relish feeling like me again a bit.
That is really interesting. And I've just remembered something which makes this sort of big revelation you've had and this feeling of freedom a sort of a shame, because I forgot that I should have told you. I should have told you before we had this whole chat.
I've listened to the podcast, so I know what you're doing.
You've died.
Yeah.
You've died. So listen, good that you had that feeling of freedom very, very briefly.
Before. I've just died in this moment now, in this very
You're moment, dead.
I am dead.
Well, I've just, I actually found out a while back and I forgot to tell you.
You are. Death,
in a way.
The Grim Reaper.
How did you die?
Well, it being the case that I've listened to your podcast before, and I know right. that in about an hour's time you're going to make it try and sound as grim and disgusting and foul as possible, I'm going to challenge you.
That's not my vibe.
I'm going to challenge you by saying the truth, which is that I hope that I died very peacefully and comfortably and old, surrounded by loved ones squeezing my hand gently. Or you're going to say I have to have died in this minute now?
No, you can die like this. This is taking place in a sort of timeless zone. Okay. So you can be as old as you want. How old were you?
I would like to be 100, because when I was a kid I thought that's how old you live till.
Yeah, you get a letter from the Queen
and then that's it.
And then loved ones around your bed, and one of them squeezes your hand to death.
One of them squeezes my hand to death. Yeah, it's they love me so very much that they crush my fingers, which causes.
I'm
not getting pulled into this. Lured into your.
It's quite grim, a dark, I mean, yeah. Quite a horrific death, really.
No.
Squeezes your head, got sepsis.
No, these law and loving, and I barely noticed it, to be honest. I slipped off into the never after is what I did.
Okay. Do you worry about death, Ben Barnes?
I used to worry about death a lot. I was definitely that kid who actually probably didn't want to talk about it very much, because it just feels a bit overwhelming. And I think it still does, even though I think through your life you obviously can't but have more experience with it and be exposed to it more, and the reality of it, you're faced with the reality of it, that perspective is brought much closer to your face. But I still, you know, I still put it in the category of sort of in infinity and time and all those kinds of things that I will never have a handle on, and so it doesn't really serve me to think about it too much. But yeah, I think I probably am fearful, I think, of death. I think hope is probably one of my defining characteristics, and it's the one thing you can't be hopeful. I don't seem to be able to find hope in. But I will say that there are things that along the way that have made me feel so much more alive that it sort of becomes, and I know people have said this to you before, but it all becomes so much more precious for the fact that you know it's temporary.
Do you imagine anything happening after you die?
Somebody once, I wish I could remember who, but somebody once said to me, "What do you remember before you were born?" And I said, "Nothing." And they said, that doesn't it stand to reason that you probably won't feel or know anything after you're gone? And that's, to me, so far, is the best argument that's been put forward. And I'm open, but.
Do you know what? I've been thinking about that. I obviously hate that one. I hate that there was nothing before, so there's nothing after. Because then I also think, yeah, but when you're born, like humans in particular are the least, you know, born with anything. The only thing they can do is find a nipple, right? That's literally all a baby's.
Yeah, no, a giraffe is up and walking in 15 minutes.
Horses are carrying people, raising their own kids by a week. You know what I mean? Like,
So when people say
like, what did you know before you were born? It's like, nothing. You didn't know anything, because when you were born, the only thing you knew was find a nipple. So it's like, when you died, you know a lot more by that point. So maybe this blank nothingness, there's a lot more going on. That's my new theory I just come up with.
Yeah. Sorry, I'm still stuck on the sort of like the main.
How useless babies are.
No, more of the sort of like main thrust of human existence to find the nipple doesn't, you know, I know people for whom that doesn't change very much as they go through life, I think.
Absolutely doesn't. That's still it. Everything else is just sort of gravy around that, isn't it? I've got good news for you, Ben Barnes. There is a heaven. And
it's great.
It's great. You'll love it there.
And it's brilliant. It is brilliant.
It's brilliant. It's brilliant. It's got all your favorite. It's got your favorite thing in it. What's your favorite thing?
Oh, I think it's. Yeah, I think it's. Guys, there's got to be music. Yeah.
Well, then this heaven is filled with music. There's music everywhere, except during screenings when it would be inappropriate. But there's music everywhere. You sit on music. You sleep on music. There's music in the trees, and it's lovely. Everyone's very excited to see you. They're all big fans. But they want to talk to you about your life.
Famous in heaven.
Yeah, it's like Comic-Con. It's like Comic-Con, but with nice music.
Welcome to the ever after. Do you mind just finding, can I just, quick photo?
Okay, no one knows who the fuck you are, but so then you turn up, you're a stranger. So people are like, who are you? Let's talk about your life through film. Oh yeah, you're right, that is much better. The first thing they ask is, what's the first film you remember seeing, Ben Barnes?
Do you know what? This was one of the ones that I struggled with the most to have one answer, because when people sort of say, oh yeah, don't you remember your first time you ever ate a banana, or I remember being born? No, you don't. You don't. No one remembers anything before they're about six, I reckon. So this was actually one I struggled with. I certainly remember sort of seeing the Disney's of Sword in the Stone and Robin Hood and all that very early on. And, The Neverending Story and Flight of the Navigator and The Labyrinth, those sort of like early Quest, early 80s things were very, those are definitely, those are the ones that were around, but I couldn't put my finger on what the first one was that I can remember.
Well, let's go with Flight of the Navigator, because we haven't talked about that on here for a while. What a movie. What an 80s movie.
My favourite part of that film definitely was when he gets to space camp and he goes to his room and there's all these like sort of NASA things on his bed. He's got the spaceman ice cream and he's got his jumpsuit and it's all like laid out in this like perfect way on his like perfectly made bed. And it's all, he gets it basically a welcome pack That is my most vivid memory from that film, and I haven't seen it since I was a kid, and I can still remember that. I don't know what that says about anything, if it says anything about me, but that is the frame of the film that I remember the most.
That is interesting. You like free gifts. You like a swag bag. That's what it tells us. You like a t-shirt, you like some merch.
Yeah, how ironic. I've just released my own merch for my music. No, it's not about merch. It's not about merch. I think it's about he's worried about it, about going there. And I think it's welcoming and it's loving the way it's sort of set out. And I think that it's like doing nice things for people.
Do you remember when you saw your early films thinking, I want to do this, I want to be an actor?
No, I think that came much, much later, mid-teens, I think. It's because I was sort of quite good at quite a lot of things, but not very good at anything. And I think I felt a bit invisible and a bit sort of like lost and a bit like I needed to sort of pick something. And I think that obviously, you know, this is an industry that you go into and then you are sort of seen. You're literally on a stage. And I think it was something that I could maybe devote myself and maybe try to get good at. I think it was just about trying to sort of focus on one thing, but I was never really able to do that because I was sort of too interested in lots of things. But it was sort of through music actually, and then it was sort of, you know, musical, and then the song part sort of got stripped away and it became about storytelling, and then I found a love of that latterly.
Interesting. What's the film that scared you the most? Do you like being scared?
No, I don't. And I said I would never do a horror film, and I've literally just finished work on a horror. Guillermo del Toro is doing an anthology horror series called The Cabinet of Curiosities. It's a bit sort of Black Mirror-ish, but instead of tech, it's all sort of horror tropes. And I've just finished it this week.
How was it?
A very creepy, creepy, scary episode of it with all manner of grisly things and a really terrifying, ending.
Oh, great.
And I purposefully asked the director and the team to mess with me as much as possible and to stop me at doing any acting. Because I called him and said, look, I've been doing this 20 years, but I haven't really played anyone that sort of scared a lot. And it's not a genre that I'm very familiar with. When I was looking down your list, I looked up like the 100 scariest films ever, and I'd seen about two of them. So I was like, well, it's not on this list. So I was getting them to bang bits of wood together and play horrible scream at me during takes, if possible, just to sort of mess with me. And I did not like it. And I still won't watch anymore, but I will watch that. But one of the things that he was asking me about, can I play some sounds? And I suddenly had this memory of the film The Return to Oz, which is a sequel to The Wizard.
Yeah, it's the most terrifying.
The Wheelies.
The Wheelies.
These creatures look like sort of human circus clowns, but they've got wheels instead of hands and feet, and they squeak. So the director, because it requires me to be scared of things that aren't really there a lot, this job I've just done. And so he would play on speakers the sounds of the Wheelies during takes just to fuck with me and mess with me, and it worked, and it was horrible. And then I remembered that sort of Alice in Wonderland thing of her falling down, I think it's Dorothy or Dorothy's door or whoever it is, falling down this sort of rabbit hole, but there's hands grabbing at her in this horrible sort of gropey way. And those two images are, again, I haven't seen it in so many years because why would you put yourself through that again? But those images are really, really stuck with me.
It's bananas, Return to Oz. It's fucking like when you watch it, you're like, I cannot believe this was a Disney film that got made for kids. It's so scary.
No, someone was on some drugs.
Yeah, yeah. There's heads in fucking, there's a whole cabinet of heads. It's the scary shit.
It's horrible. It's horrible. Although when I was a kid, I can tell you what film scared me the most. I mean, obviously I saw that when I was probably quite young, but as a little kid, I remembered this story, and maybe I remember it, and maybe it's just because my dad has told it to me about me to various people in front of me many times, which is that I think on about my fifth or sixth birthday, I was on one of those channel ferries, and it was my birthday. And there was a little screening room on the ferry, and they were playing Roald Dahl's The Witches. And there is the moment in the middle of the film, for anyone who hasn't seen it, where the witches remove their wigs and gloves and skin, and they look pretty gruesome. And at that point in the film, apparently, according to myth and legend, I waltzed down. This was very out of character, but I waltzed down to the front of, I hate public speaking as myself, by the way. You should know this about me. I'm so scared of it. So scared of it. And walked down to the screen at the front, turned around and said in the most precocious way possible, "Well, this is a bit too scary, isn't it?" And walked out. And my dad had to sort of run after me because he was like, "You just left. Like, I couldn't bear it. I'm going to make a scene." So
I'm jumping overboard. Good day.
So I have never told anyone that, but my dad has told lots of people.
Why do you think you're so scared of talking as yourself? I mean, I sort of understand, but do you know why?
Well, I don't know. In my newfound revelation about not being so worried about it, maybe I'm not. Anymore. I don't know quite what it is. Maybe it's just too long sort of doing it in front of people as someone else. But I do get, even on the wrap of a film or something, when that in the 30 seconds you have to say thank you to a crew that I'm so grateful for, my heart just goes a bit too fast, my palms go a bit sweaty, and I'm not quite sure, my words get jumbled up, and I don't know why that is, because I'm very comfortable doing this with you. I'm very comfortable in any sort of social situation, but when it's suddenly you're sort of when it's and there's a pressure on it, expectation is the mother of all fucking horror, isn't it? And I think that, you know, whenever you're sort of expected to say something, I sort of clam up and get a bit tight.
I think I've just sort of realised that it's actually not, I'm not worried about necessarily being embarrassed, because you can just go, "Oh, thank you very much," and keep it very short. But I think it's about sort of letting people's perception of who they think I am down, not being charismatic enough, or not being eloquent or charming enough. Right. Not being enough, I think, is what's fueled a lot of that stuff over the years for me, of which I've now managed to sort of let go of a bit.
You are enough.
That's the title of this episode.
Ben Barnes is enough.
No, Ben Barnes, colon.
You are enough.
You are enough. What's the, speaking of crying, what's the film that made you cry the most? Are you a crier?
Yeah, I like a good cry. The film that made me cry the most, and it made me cry for about 3 days, almost nonstop, because I think I saw it just too young, was Spartacus.
Oh, really?
It's a very specific reason, which was when you get to the end of the film, Kirk Douglas and Tony Curtis are forced to fight to the death, on penalty of death, obviously. They're both going to be crucified unless they fight to the death, in which case only the victor will be crucified and the other one will be killed by their best friend. And the catharsis of this, a word that I didn't know at 8 or whenever I saw it, but that sort of unbearable pressure and tension and the fact that they both love the other so much that they can't bear to be the one that would put them through the agony of the crucifixion, and so they actually fight harder for it. There was something in my 8-year-old, however old I was, brain that just had a schism, and I could not bear the idea that anyone could come up with this. And I remember being in tears for days about it, inconsolable. Yeah.
Interesting. I'm sorry for your loss. What is the film that you love? It's not critically acclaimed. Most people don't like it, but you don't give a fucking shit what anyone says. You will stand by this film.
Sister Act 2.
I love Sister Act 2. Thank you. Back in the habit. Yes, please.
There are moments of Sister Act 2 that I will pull up on YouTube at any given opportunity, when Lauryn Hill sings a bit of Eyes on the Sparrow at the organ, or the sort of like joyful at the end. I think I just love Lauryn Hill's voice so much, and it's so much more exciting than the first one, and it follows all the proper sort of like traits of those kinds of cheesy films, when they take the robes off at the end and the dancing and the mum turning up and all of that, and locking Father Creasy or whatever in the cupboard with a salami. Come on. I won't hear a word against it.
It's flawless. It gave us Lauryn Hill. It's flawless. You can have that.
thanks. Wait, does that mean I've not been able to have anything so far?
Yeah, up to now. up to now, none of them have been allowed through. But this one.
I didn't realize it was a challenge element to it.
Nor did I, but until this moment, and we're both learning.
Everyone else has got every film they've ever said through, but you so far.
Yeah, but
that one.
This has been quite a strict process of this episode. I don't know why, but for some reason. It's a much bigger filter.
I think it's because I looked at the list of films that you said I mustn't talk about and thought, I need to mention several of these. So I'm poo-pooing your system.
And the system is fighting back. What's the film you used to love? You loved it. You've watched it recently. You've gone, oh, no, I don't like this no more. But for your own reasons.
So I'm sure there are lots of those, and I couldn't think of them. But what I could think of was one of my favorite films of all time. And I've got a collection in my home of 80s movies, original posters of 80s movies that I just loved and have a connection to, some of which are on your list of things I'm not allowed to talk about. But one of them is The Princess Bride, which I think is one of the greatest films ever made.
One of the greatest films ever made.
However... Great. It's one of those films that I'll peddle to people and say, this is one of the greatest films ever made. What do you mean you haven't seen it? I'll say, because my cast, especially of my cast of the show that I do on Netflix, they're in their early 20s mainly. Right. Some of them haven't seen it. They watched it and sort of came back, and a couple of them came back and said, yeah, I got about 30 minutes in. I didn't really get it. So I went back and watched it again, thinking maybe it's a bit dated. Maybe it doesn't quite hold up. It absolutely fucking does. It's brilliant. And they're wrong.
It's brilliant.
They're wrong. So there's a film that does hold up, which is, I think, what you asked.
Do you know what? I like you flipping the question. I'm going to let that through. It was cheeky.
Brilliant.
But I'm letting it through because I love The Princess Bride.
I feel a bit like I'm Room 101, which I did used to watch as a kid, and I don't think it's on anymore. But I always wanted to go on that, and this is about as close as I'm ever going to get, and I'm going to enjoy it.
For one episode only, this is seeming to take that format. Now, what is the film that means the most to you, Ben Barnes? Not necessarily the film itself is any good, but because the experience you had around seeing it that will always make it meaningful to you.
Again, there are a few, but this film is very good, but it only sort of makes it into the pantheon of one of my favourites because of what I saw it, which was the film that I saw on my first ever date I ever went on was, and I realised my mistake after the fact. And I don't know why there weren't more people in my life to tell me that this film was setting unreasonable standards, was Baz Luhrmann's Romeo and Juliet. Came out in the cinema, and the day it was released in the cinema was my first ever proper date I took someone on.
Wow. How old were you?
I don't know. Probably 14 or 15.
Okay. And what happened on the date?
It was actually wonderful. It was actually wonderful. She was a sweetheart, and I. It's actually quite a sad, again, working against the comedy of your podcast format. But we dated for a few months, I think, and just sort of hung out and watching films at each other's houses, and it was so innocent and lovely. And I found out that she went on a gap year and an accident passed away, and I read it in the local paper, and I remember that night thinking about it and watching Romeo and Juliet again, and I can't
separate it in my head from that.
God, that's so fucking tragic. I'm so sorry.
Yeah, it was a weird thing. I've actually never told anyone that before, but
so you hadn't seen her for like a couple of years when that happened, or just.
It had been probably 4 years or something. It was we weren't in touch or anything, but and then a couple of years ago, one of my best pals took me to the secret cinema version of it, where they do bits of it live and everything, and that helped reframe it a little bit. It was raining the night we saw it, and it helped reframe it a little bit, but it definitely has that association in my mind.
Ben Barnes,
Don't get me wrong, it's a fond memory because it was a very lovely thing.
Yeah, I can see that. It's a sort of beautiful thing as well. What's a film you most relate to?
Okay, so this is stupid because I'm sure there are millions and that are probably... I was thinking there's got to be something sort of a bit romantic and Hugh Grant-y or something. There's got to be something that I'm...
There's got to be something out there.
I was thinking the thing that jumped to mind was the opening scene of Swingers, Jon Favreau calling the girl back 42 times and getting increasingly more pathetic with each one. And for some reason, I find this incredibly relatable. Not because it's something I've particularly done, but just something that I feel like I understand better than I understand any other scene from a film. So, I don't know why that... I don't really know why that's my answer, but it is, and you're just going to... They're my answers, so that's allowed.
I fully accept that answer.
Right.
And I think it is a very relatable scene, and I've definitely done that via text. I've definitely sent a text and then thought, oh, fuck, and then sent another text and then sent another text and thought, stop sending texts.
stop it. Yeah.
And then it reads like a mad, insane novel when they finally look at it.
I think I'd sort of be also more curious to that question. I'd be more curious what other people think, what the film they think is that they've seen that reminds them of me the most. Do you know what I mean? I think as an actor, I'm always curious.
Right, yeah.
I'm always curious to know what people would, you know, people say, what do you want to do next? I'm like, I don't know. What do they want me to do next? It, sort of.
Right.
Because, you know, because that's a part of it, isn't it?
The truth is, what film do you most relate to is the question most people struggle with, which is interesting. And you get many varied answers. I'd say probably five guests that I've had in all the time have an answer like that. Most people go, oh, I really struggled with this one.
Yeah, I think it's because it's one of those ones that it's because the one I'd most want to get right. And I think I'd need much more time to look through all films I've ever seen and be like, oh yeah, that, but it didn't just come to me.
Yeah. It's because maybe if you're taking it as like, what's the film that defines me as a person, that's too big a question. Yeah.
The most intimate question in a way.
Yeah. Anyway, tell me this. Ben Barnes, I think this is why people have tuned in. What's the sexiest film you've ever seen?
I do enjoy having both my names every question. It's a lot of people do that with my name because it's alliterative in it, and I enjoy you doing
name.
But I enjoy you doing it, I think, more than anyone ever, maybe. I might have to get you a badge.
Thank you.
Sexiest film. So, yeah. I think the film that I sort of remember being the sexiest film was Y Tu Mama Tambien.
Correct.
Great. Moving on. And then more recently, I saw a film called The Handmaiden.
Correct.
Which is, I don't know if I'm allowed to find it, so it was supposed to be sexy, but it is very sexy.
It's very sexy. It's got the sexiest tooth filing scene in cinema history.
In the history of cinema, yeah.
Yeah. You'd be hard pushed to find a sexier tooth filing scene.
But in case you were going to sort of not agree with me so quickly and readily, which luckily he did, because those are very sexy films, I had a more PG answer ready, which was that the film has the date that I would most like to go on in it, which is quite sexy, The Karate Kid, preferably with Elizabeth Shue, actually, still.
What happens in the date?
They go to golf and stuff in that beautiful yellow retro car that Miss Miyagi has given him, and they go to golf and stuff, and he's sort of putting his arms around her and helping her putt away, and they're having delicious looking, fast food, and they're just giggling a lot. And it just was not an experience that I was having when I was watching that film, and I wanted it. I wanted it with Elizabeth Shue.
That's very, very sweet. Speaking of sweet, troubling boners, worrying wide-ons. What's a film you found arousing that you weren't sure you should, Ben Barnes?
I just realised that The Karate Kid was my answer to that one. Because I was going to say The Karate Kid, and then you were going to go, what?
No, I was just like, go on.
Yeah. And then I was going to explain that. sort of subverting the question and making it sweet, and now I've ruined it by offering it too early.
But what I like is what we're doing here is a deconstructed version of that bit.
Yeah,
it's you know, which is very, very LA. It's like a deconstructed taco or something.
Yeah, it's stop on it. We do it backwards. It's fine. It'll work.
Yeah, it's better this way. People, what we've done is we've given you all.
It's right.
We've given you all the ingredients. You get to make the meal yourself in your head.
I'll give you the answers, and you provide the question.
It's the Jeopardy version of it. I love it.
What is the Karate Kid?
What is troubling boner?
I'll take troubling. I'll take troubling shadow and boners for 500.
What is objectively the greatest film ever made? Not your favourite necessarily, but the greatest.
It is absolutely one of my favourites, and I know that the answer's not interesting to you because you've had it so many times before. But is Back to the Future. I've got the original poster there. I just think it's perfect, and I've always it's always been the answer that I've given about sort of my favorite film. I will say this horror show that I just finished. My co-star was Crispin Glover, who was in the film. Obviously,
how is it?
He's wonderful. Yeah, he's wonderful.
Yeah,
he's totally eccentric and loves films and making films and being, you know, sort of collaborating on it. Loves, you know, playing characters. I think didn't have the gumption to talk to him about it. It was still thrilling to sort of just to hear his voice. Actually, it was just quite. It's just probably the film I've seen the most. So.
You can have that. Of course you can have it. You can have that one.
And what we'll do is go back and anyone who said it already in the 150 episodes...
I'll delete them out of the podcast.
So I'm the only...
Actually, I'm going to... Yeah, Buddy Peace, who's the producer, when you listen to this, could you do that, please? It shouldn't take you long. What's the film that you could or have watched the most over and over again, Ben Barnes?
I always think of one of... I don't know what the film is I've watched the most. Probably one of the ones I've already mentioned. But my metric is always like that one that like when you're like in a hotel somewhere and you just sort of turn on the TV just to have some noise, and then it's 25 minutes into the film, but you just sit and watch it anyway. I've got a lot of those, I think. But you know, there's something also. I know I completely avoid the question about. Where you see yourself in it, and I'm not necessarily even sure which character, but there's something about Notting Hill that I find unavoidable. I just love it. Unashamedly love that film, and I don't know if I'm Hugh Grant or Julia Roberts or somewhere in the middle.
Yeah, you're all the characters.
But I do love it, and there's something sort of very London-y about it, which I love, and something the Hollywood coming into London, which I understand, but it just... I love the structure of those rom-coms. I've been trying to find a rom-com with that kind of just simple concept and structure for literally for 15 years. You know, I love the format. I watch a lot of kind of films except horror, but I think those sort of rom-coms, when they're done well, sort of Richard Curtis style, are my favourites.
Interesting you haven't found one in 15 years as well. I think they're very, very, very hard to get right.
And I think I've seen a lot that have been made in the last sort of 10 years, and a lot of them are not very good.
One or two that cut through, but I was not offered them.
Disgusting.
I don't know what they were thinking.
We don't like to be negative, do we, Ben Barnes?
No.
You and me are united on that.
Yeah, Hope FC.
But what's the worst film you've ever seen?
So I don't know if it's the worst film I've ever seen, because I haven't seen it since I was small, but there was a sort of running joke in my family that we were once travelling somewhere and we watched a film because I think we were sort of stuck somewhere or something, and you could only get the TV, and we watched a film called Basil, which stars Christian Slater, and it's a sort of a period Victorian-esque kind of a film, and it was completely shit. Suffering from the main cinema crime of being very, very boring. And I remember my dad saying, I think that's the worst film I've ever seen. And I said, I agree. I think that's the worst film I've ever made. And then in anticipation of this, I watched the trailer again online, and it looks suspiciously like a film version that I did of Dorian Gray, which I think most people would contend is the worst film I have been involved with, or one of at least, even though it looks very, very beautiful and there are good things about it. And it's often on telly at Christmas and people tell me they love it, but we didn't quite sort of hit.
How do you feel about it? I said, honestly, hand on my heart, I haven't seen it. I have no skin in the game of this.
Mixed feelings about it because I loved making it. I loved the producer and the director and Colin Firth, starring Colin Firth, who is one of my favourite humans.
For the listeners, he just held up a mug that said, keep calm and love Colin Firth.
Given to me by Colin Firth because you're the only one who will bloody drink out of it.
And then I found that you can buy a Keep Calm and Love Ben Barnes mug online, so I sent it to his wife.
That's very good.
Because shenanigans, for the purposes of shenanigans. Mm-hmm. But he's a wonderful human and we had a brilliant time making it. And I think we thought we were making something that was maybe perhaps a little bit edgier. I think it tried maybe to sort of be a bit edgy and make some changes, and also try to sort of please lovers of literature and faithful lovers who were hoping for a sort of faithful adaptation of the book and everything. And I think that sometimes, you know, you can do everything right and put it all in the right sort of order, but it doesn't quite capture the sort of zeitgeist of what that adaptation needs to be for this generation or whatever. It just got very, also, you know, I was 26 or something, and that was the last time I read a review because it was very poorly reviewed. Very mean, very, very mean about me. And now I'm able to use those criticisms, actually, especially for younger actors when they say, oh, you know, that so-and-so wasn't the best thing about this film or whatever. And I'm thinking, you think that's a bad review? I'll show you a bad review, mate. And I'll whip out the Daily Mail's review of Dorian Gray, which is the most scathing review of any acting performance in history, I think. But it definitely, like, knocked me off kilter at the time. Made me think, maybe I'm not made of stern enough stuff to do this. Maybe I'm a bit sensitive. But then actually it just served to sort of embolden me and make my... And actually want to be bolder in my choices, maybe, or more, it may be doubled down, maybe more committed to making a success of this and being the best, you know, just being the best actor I can be anyway. And
do you avoid all things then? Do you avoid all press? Do you avoid social media?
Yeah, I was working on the third Narnia film in Australia. And I flew to Toronto for the film festival, and the reviews came out that day. And I had to fly from Australia to Toronto and back again in a day and a half or something. And so I was upside down and inside out at that point. And I think that just the reviews coming out that time, it really knocked me.
God.
But it's you know, as I say, I think there are great things about it. I'm still really proud to have done it. I'm very proud to have been cast in it with those people and, to have been trusted with that story. Do I think I'm a better actor now? Yeah. That, you know.
Yeah, you're fucking 26 as well.
Yeah.
It's mad.
Yeah, interestingly, the horror thing that I've just done has a sort of couple of little elements of it that made me think, oh, maybe this is, you know, another go at it. And I got asked to do the audiobook, actually, of Dorian Gray, last year or the year before, and I was like, oh, I get to sort of have another go here as well. But yeah, still very proud to have been involved in it, and I think, you know, all these moves that we make, you know, make us the person that we are, and I'm proud of the person that I am. So I think.
But do I watch it? Do I watch it often? No.
Really good answer. I'm so I think it's absolutely right not to read anything, but I think it's hard. I'm impressed.
It's a hard lesson.
I suppose you're just used to it. Yeah.
The only way to learn it, of course, though, is the only possible way. You put your fingers in the fire and get burnt before you know not to touch it.
Yeah, I definitely experienced that. And God, I shouldn't have looked. Okay, what's the film? You're funny, Ben Barnes. You've been funny and stuff. What's the film that made you laugh the most?
I think the film that has made me laugh the most number of times is This Is Spinal Tap.
Correct. You've got a few of these completely right.
Oh, brilliant. Well, again, these are the ones that my collection of 80s posters, this is one of them. I get probably one of the films I watch the most. Certainly the film that if people haven't seen it, I will immediately pull up something or start quoting it, or I'll be insufferable talking about it. But it's just endlessly quotable. I mean, it's funny. Yeah. It's the first second before you've even got any actors in it, Rob Ryan is introducing it, and he does this thing where he folds his arms and then just sort of lets them... It's so uncomfortable that he sort of lets them hang down. And I cannot watch that without laughing, and nothing's happened yet. The film hasn't even started yet. And it's genius. I love it.
It really is. Ben Barnes, you've been an absolute joy. I've loved talking to you. However, when you were 100 years old, you had a birthday card from the Queen, who was at the time about 190, which was very nice for her to send a card. It was very scrawly writing, but I believe it was from her herself, and she did the post. You were a bit tired. You went to bed, and your loved ones, you said, gather round, your loved ones gathered round, and your great-great-great-granddaughter took your hand, and in a peak of madness, squeezed your hand so hard.
She was in so much despair because she loved me so very much.
Yeah, squeezed it so hard that it snapped in 25 places. She screamed. Everyone started screaming around you, right? Oh, God, what have I done? People were screaming.
I absolutely hate you. No, I know it's not real.
Chaos. All your loved ones is just so distraught. Oh, God, what have we done? And there was blood, and then the blood got infected, and you had instant sepsis, and it spread through your body quite quickly, to be fair. And then you were just choking on the infection, and then people were screaming, everyone was screaming, and you died. It was one of the least peaceful deaths I've ever seen. And I hear this chaos. I'm like, what's going on in that house? In Ben Barnes' house, it sounds like a massacre's happened. All your loved ones, they run out of the house screaming like they've been in a horror. I've got a coffin on me. You know what I'm like. Drag it upstairs. I go, where's Ben Barnes? My old detective friend, Ben Barnes, where is he? And I go up the stairs, and there you are. And your body has exploded from the instant sepsis. It's fucking everywhere. It's everywhere. On the walls, on the floor. It's disgusting. And also, insects have flown in through the window. They're already eating on your rotting flesh. I'm like, get out of here. Scram. And I scrape off all the bits of you I can. I put you in the coffin. I'm having to wear industrial gloves. It's gross. Even I'm grossed out by it. It's a mess. It's like I've made a fucking pool of cess in this coffin. Anyway, it's full. It's full. And there's only really enough room for me to slide one DVD into the gloop for you to take across to the other side. And on the other side, it's movie night every night, and one night it's your movie night. What film are you taking to show everyone in heaven when it's your movie night, Ben Barnes? Please.
I've poked the bear there, haven't I, at the beginning. I challenged you. It's like I went to a comedy show and sat in the middle of the front row thinking this will be fine. I hate you for that.
You hate how you died. Listen, I'm so sorry. It was a tragic death.
It was screaming. It made my peace.
All of them.
So horrific.
It was quick, though. It was quick.
Okay.
What film are you taking with you to show in heaven?
I am taking with me, arguably, and when I say arguably, I mean arguing with myself, because it's impossible to answer what your favourite film ever is. But the one I would most like to share with, the one I most like to share with people, the one that has brought me probably the most joy, When Harry Met Sally.
Oh, fucking perfect answer. I almost feel bad about how you died with that answer, but I'm not in charge of those things.
It's all right. I'm up in heaven.
Yeah.
And Harry Met Sally, I'm having a lovely time.
Yeah, you're having an absolutely
and everyone's going
time.
And everyone's going, oh, thanks for bringing this. Brilliant choice. What a brilliant, brilliant choice of film for us to all watch, the thing. Probably the best. Yeah, probably the best choice of all the 100 things.
You're the best person. Anyway, just before we settle down to watch this lovely film, how did you die again? You're like... Ben Buds, what a joy. Now, I assume you would like people to listen to your album. Is that what we have to look forward to next from you?
Yes.
What's it called?
It's called Songs for You, and it is five songs that I wrote at that piano, and then had some brilliant producers and people help me make more shiny sounding with exciting brilliant musicians from around the world sort of contributing their bits during the pandemic, which is kind of thrilling and amazing. And now it's this sort of little, record, which is sort of just going to be everywhere. And it's brilliant. Yeah. People have been, the first song came out a few weeks ago and people sending me, I think one of the things I love the most is just this girl dancing in her kitchen with this big smile on her face to it. And then people have been doing sort of like pole dancing or ice skating routines or doing a singing cover of it or drawing something from the music video or whatever. Just like, just feeling like, I think something about me doing it at 40 rather than at 19 when I first tried is making people go, maybe I can just do my thing now. And that feels good.
I love that. I love that. Congratulations. Congratulations on your album. That's fucking huge.
Thanks.
I hope that more and more people love it. I have loved talking with you. Thank you for your time. And good luck with everything. Have a wonderful time in heaven. And love to you. Good day, sir.
Cheery bye.
So that was episode 169. Head over to patreon.com/Brett Goldstein for the extra 20 minutes of chat, secrets and video with Ben. Go to Apple Podcasts, give us a 5-star rating, but don't talk about the show. I don't care about that. Talk about the film that means the most to you and why. It's a lovely thing to read. Helps with numbers, something like that. I don't really know why I keep saying this bit, but apparently I should. So there you go. You don't have to do it. But if you want to do it, do it. Do you know what I mean? Honestly, if it's in, don't bother. But you can. Anyway. Thank you so much to Ben for doing the show. Thanks to Scroobius Pip and the Distraction Pieces Network. Thanks to Buddy Peace for producing it. Thanks to Acast for hosting it. Thanks to Adam Richardson for the graphics and Lisa Lydon for the photography. Come and join me next week, where my special guest will be someone else amazing. You know it will be. Everyone's amazing. They're all good. I don't book shit guests. I hope you're all well. Thank you so much for listening. So that is it for now. In the meantime, have a lovely week. And please, now more than ever, be excellent to each other.